You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Check out our website at thetakeaway.org. You'll find other interesting stories, quizzes, and behind-the-scenes photos and videos.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. An hour of thinking about black boxes and their mysterious electronic innards. Later in the program, how a very mysterious black box was able to switch off some deeply ingrained social conditioning. A Montana scientist will explain why it works and why the black box might not be completely necessary. Also, the water anxiety continues in West Virginia. What happens when the black box faith in the purity of tap water is shaken by a chemical spill? And a $100 million bet that the networks and cable companies are trying to enslave us all with their set-top boxes. The Supreme Court takes up a case of people who want their free TV. But we begin with another look inside the National Security Agency, at the center of the so-called black budget in the U.S. defense and intelligence programs. Tomorrow, President Obama will finally outline his plans to reconfigure the NSA. The recommendations will complete a review process the president claimed he always wanted to start, but which actually began only in the wake of Edward Snowden's bombshell revelations about the NSA's extensive domestic surveillance programs. The president is expected to address both the vast data collection capability of the NSA, as well as the agency's alleged disregard for even the modest existing oversight mechanisms. But Senator Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, doesn't expect much to change.
We believe, the Intelligence Committee, that the program is legal. I am hopeful that the program will be sustained by the president, maybe in a slightly different form. And I think for the president to take action is absolutely acceptable. I may disagree with some of it. I don't know, because I don't know what the action would be. But I think that's the proper thing.
Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein speaking yesterday with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. A view now of the need for reform from a voice inside the intelligence community. Our next guest is no Edward Snowden whistleblower, though. He is skilled in the science and technology behind the NSA's data collection and data protection capability. Joseph Bonneau holds a Ph.D. in cryptology and is a fellow at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University. He won a competition sponsored by the NSA for the Best Scientific Cybersecurity Paper Award for a 2013 paper on passwords and encryption. Joseph, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Great. So first of all, explain this paper and why you may have won this award.
So it was actually a paper I wrote 2 years ago as a PhD student, kind of the culmination of the research I did as a student that brought some cryptographic formalism to studying passwords for the first time. It was an exciting time to be doing this research because we had big data sets on password for the first time in the past couple years. And the goal of the competition was to look at people bringing more scientific understanding to hard cybersecurity problems. Passwords has been one of those for a long time. So I think that's why my paper got picked by the panel of judges.
And what do you think of the criticism of the NSA and its profile now that Edward Snowden has really outlined an agency that has vast capability that seems to violate the Constitution?
Yeah, I mean, coming from the academic research community, most academics, most people working independently in cryptography, independently of the government sector, probably would go much further in criticisms of the NSA than I think the public generally has.
What do you think the NSA does improperly, and what do you think is the proper role, speaking as a cryptologist, for an agency like the NSA protecting Americans from external threats?
Well, I think the biggest problem right now is that there's so much that we still don't know that it's hard on a technical level to even really say if they're how bad the problem is. I think what we've seen in the past year has confirmed some of the worst fears that the tech community has about what the NSA is up to. It's possible that there's a whole lot more there that we just don't see right now. Relying on leaks from Snowden, which was kind of a fluke event, to me drives home the point that, I mean, that could be everything. It could just be the tip of the iceberg. So I almost don't even have a full technical opinion so much as I would say that the problem is not being able to make an independent assessment technically of what the NSA is doing.
As a scientist, how did your view of the NSA change with the Snowden revelations? And when the NSA recognized you, did you feel as though this was an opportunity for you to express your criticisms? Or did you in some way feel as though you'd been drawn into the entire scandal?
Yeah, it was definitely a mixed blessing. I think as a scientist, anytime somebody recognizes your work, especially when the award was actually picked, not by NSA personnel, but by an independent panel of academics, some of whom are my colleagues and all of whom I respected a lot, it was a big honor to have my work recognized by those people. But the fact that the award was sponsored by the NSA brought just immediate mixed feelings about accepting this award and if that implied any kind of endorsement of the NSA by taking it. And it was something that I thought about and talked to colleagues and advisors for a while and got different advice, but ended up coming down on the side that I was able to accept the award and, in fact, give me more platform to say what I thought about the NSA, which I was very pointed about after winning the award, that major changes were needed. And in all probability, I think the NSA is going to have to be either split up or abolished or completely changed in terms of the government oversight of it. The fact that I was still able to say that after winning the award hopefully put enough distance between myself and my own views and the agency that had sponsored the award.
Generally speaking, though, in the cryptology world, there is a long-standing relationship between government and academia as far as development of this kind of technology is concerned, yes?
For sure, definitely. And it's a pretty tortured relationship. It's been uneasy for a long time. The NSA has been involved in the public process for developing and standardizing cryptographic technology. In fact, in the track record, sometimes the NSA has actually specifically helped by making cryptographic standards better because of techniques that they knew that the academic community didn't know about yet. But there was always suspicion that the NSA might be subverting or weakening crypto technology without the public knowing about it. And sadly, with the Snowden revelations, we have one clear-cut case of that happening and a couple of other very suspicious cases. And this has really poisoned the relationship, I think, between the academic community. Especially considering the academic community is very international. There's cryptographers from around the world that come together and work on this stuff across borders. And I think going forward, it's basically impossible for any productive collaboration to happen between the NSA and the academic community because the trust is just completely gone.
So irreparable damage. There's nothing the president can do in his reforms that you can see possibly healing this.
The divide between academic researchers and the NSA, no. I think that the breach of trust that's happened is so great. I think that academics are basically now thinking in their work and in their designs, how can we build and develop cryptographic tools that will withstand everything that the NSA has been trying to do? And we'll have to assume that the NSA is actively working against what academic researchers are generally trying to achieve. It's definitely not always the case. The NSA does have a dual mission. Part of their mission is to protect cybersecurity for the U.S. And when I went down to receive the award and chatted with people who work at the agency, I really did feel a lot of empathy. And I think a lot of the engineers working there, talking to them, I felt like, these people are really a lot like me and they care about their work. And a lot of the people within the agency really do want to work to make crypto technology in the public better. But I think it's a big agency. It's done a lot of different things. And the specific things it's done to weaken cryptography that have come out have probably damaged the brand to the point that, even people within the agency trying to have a productive collaboration with academia are going to have a hard time doing it.
In the conversations you had at the agency, do people think of Snowden as a hero, as a monster? What do you think of him?
Well, his name never came up. Keep in mind that people working at the NSA, they're not allowed to talk even internally about the Snowden revelations because the material is still classified and compartmentalized, and it's not declassified just because it's leaked. So it's very hard to have those conversations. People who work at the NSA, everyone I've ever talked to takes the mission very seriously and is very, very careful about what they say. So the conversations are they're exclusively about technology that's public, and nobody's going to directly express an opinion about Snowden. That being said, there have been some reports that morale at the NSA has gone down quite a bit, that they've had more trouble hiring, and that they've lost quite a few people who've had various crises of conscience about whether or not they want to work as part of this agency anymore.
And what do you think of Edward Snowden?
I would be very surprised if he's not pardoned at some time in my lifetime and viewed very positively by history.
Joseph Bonneau is a fellow at Princeton University's Center for Information Technology Policy. He was given an award by the NSA for Best Scientific Cybersecurity Paper. Thanks so much.
Sure thing. Good to talk to you.
So confidence can inspire. Bragging, though, that really kind of goes over the line. What do you think? Bragging. It's kind of a guy thing, right? Actually, there's a lot of psychological evidence that women are conditioned to feel a lot of anxiety when it comes to singing their own praises. And so women avoid bragging. We solicited some of our own data points on precisely that question.
This is Michelle from Oakland, California. Recently, I have experienced an opportunity to toot my horn, which I did take, although I was uncomfortable. I had a job interview, and I went for it. I sort of pretended to be an actress, playing the role of interviewee, and it made it a bit easier to just go ahead and talk grandly about things I had done. And it worked. I got the job.
This is Christina Whitehouse Suggs from Columbia, South Carolina. I had the opportunity to interview for a job that I really thought I had no idea of getting, and so I was completely honest and sold myself as best I could, thinking that they would never consider me. And lo and behold, I was hired and was the first woman in the associate coordinator position. It was pretty cool.
Very cool. Christina and Michelle should be congratulated there for overcoming their predispositions to keep quiet about their attributes. It took Susan Roberts in Pennsylvania time to get there. She wrote to us on Facebook, "I've been drawing, painting, creating for most of my life. In the last year, I have finally been able to call myself an artist. I always thought I was bragging if I called myself that." Don't know the gender here. From Texas, we got this text. "I made the mistake of saying I am customer service during an interview one time. I don't think my attempt at self-confidence worked out since I did not hear from them later on." Anthony Shank from Plano, Texas, gives us the view from an employer. "I would promote," he says, "the modest person and not the braggart. Modesty is more endearing to me. The women in the story that promoted their peers rather than themselves seem more noble to me. We used to hold modesty in a higher regard." Later in the program, we're going to look at a social scientist in Montana who has come up with a way to steer women away from their anxieties about bragging. Hint, it's both more and less than a big black box. But call us with your story. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Sing your praises. One sign of the increasing visibility of West Virginia's continuing water problems is lawyer Aaron Brockovich showing up in Charleston.
We've got to stop our laissez-faire attitude about safety last, money first, because it's not working. It's not making any business sense to me.
Brockovich speaking in Charleston there, and she says her firm is investigating the spill that has affected the water of more than 300,000 West Virginians, some of whom may end up as plaintiffs, suing those responsible for leaching the chemical MCHM, a solvent used in the coal extraction process, into the water supply. Coal is a big industry in the state, and while more people are getting their taps turned back on...
The neighbor came out and said, "Did you know?" And I rushed over. I rushed back to my parents and got theirs flushed, then rushed over here and started working on mine.
That's Charleston resident Bobby Holland, overjoyed there over the restoration of her water yesterday. But there are still contamination worries, even in neighborhoods where the water has been deemed safe, safe to shower in, safe to cook with, safe to drink. Joining me now, Dr. Elizabeth Brown, Charleston-based general practitioner, internal medicine doctor who has been treating victims of the chemical spill. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So there's two categories here. One, people who have actually been contaminated with MCHM, and then people who are probably calling you with worries and concerns about being able to trust their water supply. What are you seeing?
I am seeing a mix of all of that. I think people are scared. I think people are nervous. We're not getting any information on the safety of the water, even after it's been deemed safe to flush. There is no long-term data on MCHM. There's not even any short-term data on it. There's really nothing that we can be certain about.
Now, when you say safe to flush, that means the recommendation that people can then run their water, get the water flushed from their pipes, and the new supply is free of contamination, right?
Correct. We were given a protocol by West Virginia American Water as to how to flush our system, and most people followed that recommendation. And soon after they used that water that was supposedly safe, they started to develop some concerning symptoms.
What sorts of symptoms? Let me see what the range is you're getting.
The first ones that I saw Monday afternoon were in the form of skin rashes. I had a couple of patients who flushed their systems, then waited about 45 minutes. Then one gentleman ran his hands under the water and sustained a pretty severe rash. He had a swelling of his hands, some welts, and even what appeared to be a chemical burn under his wedding band. The other gentleman showered and sustained a head-to-toe rash. It was involving the scalp, the face, the back, the trunk. It was very painful, itching, burning. Those were the first symptoms. As people started to drink the water, we began to see sore throats, nosebleeds, some nausea, vomiting, and even people with breathing difficulties had some trouble after inhaling the steam or the vapors of the water.
Well, that sounds pretty nasty. How easy is it to link all of these symptoms to a specific contaminant?
Well, it's a little bit tricky, and I don't know that all of the symptoms are a direct cause of the water. I think we can be confident that the skin irritation sustained right after exposing yourself to the water is a pretty good link. I think we have to keep in mind it's still cough, cold, and flu season, so we are going to be encountering some normal germs, and maybe some of the symptoms are not due to the water. I think it's now the job of the physician and our responsibility to see these patients, document everything, and then do some testing and long-term follow-up to try to figure it out.
I can already hear the lawyers arguing over whether it's cold and flu season or this contamination that's behind the symptoms, but I suspect you've had to do a little brush up on your college chemistry. What does this chemical agent do in its normal uses, and how might we extrapolate what it would do on the skin?
That's the problem. There is no information on that. This has never tested in humans. There is one study that was done on lab rats, and the study involved the lethal dose. It was called the LD50, or the median lethal dose to kill rats when they fed it to them. And based on that number, the scientists did a series of uncertainty factors, extrapolating how it would affect humans and then trying to extrapolate to a non-harmful level and then doing another factor to try to arrive at that less than one part per million figure. There is no data to back that up. And from what I'm seeing, people who are using water that's supposed to be safe, it's really not.
You know, how much is this, the sort of aftermath, also an anxiety concern, where people who absolutely trust their water, I mean, you turn on your tap, you don't think about it, and then all of a sudden you have a constant worry, and even if you're told the water is fine, you're still going to have anxiety. Are you dealing with people who are just nervous and basically freaked out?
Absolutely. I did a live web chat with our local news station last night for an hour and a half, literally answering people's questions. People are scared. People need to know they're not alone. And part of the scariest part is that our health department has come out and said, we have to believe the water company. We have to believe it's safe. They're telling us it's safe. So that's what we have to believe. And my feeling is that I'm not ready to believe that. I will believe it when it's zero parts per million and I have not seen any rashes or new problems. And then there's the concern about the long-term effects. We don't know how it accumulates in the body. We don't know how it's metabolized. And we don't know any effects on unborn children. This is certainly something that I'm seeing a lot of anxiety for.
And you're certainly going to see the results of that about 9 months from now, or even a few months from now, as the implications for pregnant women become clear at birth, and God forbid there are any problems.
Well, the CDC just last night came out with the recommendation that pregnant women do not drink this water. Up until yesterday, everybody was told it was safe. And that's just, I think, the beginning of some revisions to the recommendations that are being made. And of course, we don't know anything about it. So I don't know how anyone can say that it is safe at this point.
Is this a public water company or a private company that manages the water in Charleston?
I believe it's public because the range of area has spanned about 9 counties. It's one of the largest systems here in the Kanawha Valley, and it's affected 300,000 people.
Do people trust this company? Has it had a good reputation up until now?
I believe it has. I think the company has done an amazing job at getting things cleaned up. It was actually Freedom Industries, who is a company that was helping with the coal cleanup process, that had the error. It was not West Virginia American Water. But now the water company is doing a lot of the testing, and they are the ones that are saying the water is safe. So I think they are still in this. I think they need to be maybe a little more vigilant, and I want to see more data.
Dr. Elizabeth Brown, Charleston, West Virginia-based general practitioner who's been treating victims of the chemical spill that has restricted access to water for as many as 300,000 people in West Virginia. Dr. Brown, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You know, the NFL did the New York, New Jersey area a favor when it agreed to put the 2014 Super Bowl at MetLife Stadium, just across the Hudson River from New York City, where the Giants and Jets play. Now the question is, will the February weather in this part of the world return the favor? According to AccuWeather.com, we may get a repeat of the polar vortex effect in late January, early February. The polar vortex will act like a giant pinwheel or anchor for waves of cold air and clipper storms from the upper Midwest to the Northeast through the second half of the month, according to AccuWeather. Looking back in history, it's kind of a mixed bag. There was a record winter storm in 1976, the legendary Groundhog Day gale, huge amounts of snow downwind of the Great Lakes. 1961, a blizzard from February 2nd to February 5th, snowdrifts up to 15 feet. For Colin Kaepernick and Russell Wilson, more used to the fog of San Francisco or the rain of Seattle, it could be really nasty. And what about all those ticket holders? How many souvenir sweaters and cushions can you possibly buy if the weather turns bad there in MetLife Stadium? So we thought, hey, let's create a little solidarity here at The Takeaway and WNYC for all the folks that will be shelling out big bucks to be at this game. Public radio listeners all across the country, we're here to help you out at halftime. Something to go with your Bruno Mars and Red Hot Chili Peppers music and dance and whatever they do. Let's make some hot food for all those chilly game faces in the stands. Let's get beyond the nachos, the boring potluck, shall we? We're hosting a recipe contest, people, Takeaway style. We want your best Super Bowl halftime recipes. Wait, soup or bowl recipes. Get it? That'll work. Give me your best recipes. They're either soup, piping hot food that goes in a bowl, something. People, we want recipes for real food, but can we get someone like Dan Pashman to judge this? You know, Dan of the Sporkful podcast, you know, the podcast that explores all things food and fun. Dan Pashman, can you help us out here?
Hey, John.
What do you think? Would you judge this Super Bowl contest where we're asking people to bring hot food that can go in a bowl to commiserate with the freezing cold people out there at the halftime show at the Super Bowl at MetLife Stadium?
John, I would be honored. As a Giants season ticket holder, I have spent a lot of cold winter days at MetLife Stadium.
All right, you're going to serve us here. What we need is a couple of pointers. It's got to be in a bowl. It needs to be able to go into a thermos. You know, you got to be able to transport it. What's going to work as comfort food at halftime at MetLife Stadium if it's 10 below zero?
Comfort food, first of all, I think it's got to have, it's got to be hearty. This is not a little sort of light, watery broth. There's got to be some oomph there. I want some kind of protein. Doesn't have to be meat, but there's got to be something I can stick my teeth into.
Hot-blooded vegans are welcome.
That's exactly right. And then I think beyond that, you want something that's just got a little bit of that kind of an X factor. It's just not the kind of food you would eat every day.
All right. I'm kind of depressed, Dan.
Why?
It sounds to me like you're basically signaling the audience, just send me your chili recipes, okay? Because I don't want to work really hard here.
No, not at all. There are many wonderful, hot, soul-warming dishes that could be hearty and decadent that wouldn't involve any of the components of chili.
Gumbo could work.
Absolutely.
Vichyssoise, no.
You know, it's the kind of thing, you know it when you eat it.
Do Do you dare our audience to come up with a portable halftime show bouillabaisse?
I think we just did.
Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, John.
Okay, takeaway listeners, whether your team made it to the playoffs or not, we dare you to give us your best, highest brow, heartiest hot recipe. It's got to be either soup or something that's hot and can be served in a bowl. Soup or bowl, folks. Send your recipes to thetakeaway.org. Dan and the foodie folks here at WNYC will whittle down the best entries to four dishes and before game day. If you want to brag about your recipe, tell us about it on Twitter. Hashtag soup or bowl. All one word. A chance to win the national glory of Dan and I noshing your recipe on air. And huge bragging rights when you serve your inspired recipe to all of your friends, presumably at your very own Super Bowl party.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the science of gender and bragging. But imagine if getting a perfect score wasn't something to brag about in your job, but was a minimum standard. Get a 100% on a test or lose your job. Once a month, the military makes the people who are responsible for operating this nation's nuclear missile arsenal take a test they must score perfectly to keep their jobs. Now the Air Force has disclosed that 34 officers in the force have been suspended for cheating on their proficiency test or not reporting cheating by others at Maelstrom Air Force Base in Montana. Joining us is retired Air Force Colonel Randall Larson. Hello, Colonel. Welcome.
Good morning.
What do you know about this and the conditions of both this test and the kinds of jobs that these, you know, missile silo monitors actually have day to day?
Well, this goes all the way back to 1948 when General Curtis LeMay took over Strategic Air Command. And he said, we're going to have these thermonuclear weapons, and I'm talking about weapons that are 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And he says, there's just no room for mistakes. And back, that culture was created in Strategic Air Command way back in 1948, and General LeMay commanded it for 9 years. And it was just these 100% on tests, no mistakes. And it was a culture that I was never part of Strategic Air Command. I had a lot of colleagues who were, and there was always these urban myths or stories about that cheating was not uncommon because of this incredibly high standard. It's an embarrassment as for me. As a former Air Force officer, I thought the Secretary of the Air Force, Deborah Lee, stated it very well yesterday for the American public. It's an embarrassment. It's a scandal. But the American public should know there was no serious threat about a nuclear accident because of this. Frankly, I'm more worried about the story that some of the missile launch officers tested positive for drugs. That, to me, is a little bit more concerning. I was not a missile officer. I was a pilot. And so, believe me, in fact, I was a commander of the VIP unit here at Andrews Air Force Base. And the idea of one of our pilots using drugs is a scary thought, and perhaps even scarier that missile launch officers would be involved in using drugs. So,
now, can you just clarify,
bothers me.
Colonel, can you clarify that allegation? I mean, are there concerns that there's drug use on the people responsible for the arsenal?
Reported in the media yesterday, and I believe in the newspapers this morning, that in addition to this cheating scandal, there were three officers, I believe, who tested positive for illegal drugs.
But you have no specific knowledge of the allegation that you can add to those reports that, again, the Air Force is not.
The fact, as a former officer and a U.S. citizen, that bothers me more than the cheating scandal based on what I know about these little tests they got to take every week or whatever.
Let me go back to the cheating, though, for just a moment. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the 100% standard comes from a culture of no mistakes, and, you know, that seems like a pretty good idea. Are you saying that maybe it's unrealistic to have a 100% standard and that the Air Force should back off, or do we just have the wrong people doing these jobs?
Well, you know, that's a tough one because Admiral Rickover had the same sort of standards when they put the nuclear missiles on our submarine fleets in the Navy, and he was a fanatic about the same thing. And I think that fanaticism from both LeMay and Rickover to say these are the most dangerous weapons ever built and there's not room for mistakes. Now, the question is, does that mean you got to get 100% on every test? I don't know. That puts a lot of pressure on people that all of a sudden, you know, you lose your job if you get 98 on the test or whatever. So I think that's something the Air Force will probably look at. But, I mean, you know, as a military officer, the code is you won't cheat and you won't tolerate those around you who cheat. And so it certainly will be a big investigation. But once again, if the allegations I've seen in the press are true about the drugs, I'm more worried about that.
All right. Retired Colonel Randall Larson on the allegations of recreational drug use and cheating on proficiency tests among people responsible for monitoring and maintaining the nuclear arsenal at Maelstrom Air Force Base in Montana. Colonel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Chuck.
That's right, folks. Don't touch that dial.
Well, I am the sign from the radio. Who's laying along on the living room floor?
I am the slime from your video, Frank Zappa from 1973. Slime may be an overstatement, but is the box on top of your TV set trying to enslave you into paying more for TV programming you needn't pay for at all? The U.S. Supreme Court has now decided to consider this issue when it takes the case of the company Aereo, a streaming television service that picks up digital TV signals the way an old low-tech antenna does from the broadcast airwaves and then streams it to your computer or any device with a Wi-Fi connection, bypassing cable boxes, subscription channels to deliver ABC, NBC, Fox, and other broadcast channels that hold the rights to air events like the Oscars, the Super Bowl, as well as their own hit shows. The Supreme Court will rule on whether Aereo's service is an innovation or whether it's simply using the Internet to steal the creative content of broadcasters. The National Association of Broadcasters told us enshrined in the Constitution is the concept that content creators deserve to be protected from product theft. We look forward to the resolution of this case. But we spoke with Aereo's founder and CEO, Chet Kanojia. He says while his technological innovation has been a good business so far, this case, in his view, is all about freedom.
The issue that people don't understand is broadcast television is free to consumers, and they have the ability using an antenna to watch it, record it for themselves, and that's been true for over two decades. And then there should not be a restriction on where the consumer stores that particular file.
You're taking advantage of free television. Has the free television service in the time that Aereo has come into existence become a better value, or has it just been a deteriorating kind of old media way of, you know, watching NBC, ABC, and Fox?
We believe, and I think there's data suggests that it has been increasing over the last few years. In fact, there are a number of basic cable channels who have been declining in their performance from a value perspective to the consumer. And there is absolutely no reason why for a consumer to have a basic lifeline service, that they should be forced to take a cable bundle of hundreds of channels because they just want 5, 6, or 10 channels.
What's the argument of the networks that is most persuasive to you and that you're most worried about?
I am sympathetic to the networks in this particular way, which is the business is changing, the marketplace is changing, and any of these changes that impact them, they're large public companies, they're good companies. The issue that they face is they have to evolve with the marketplace. And I'm sympathetic to the fact that their businesses are under attack by consumer behavior, which is a very difficult place to be. I mean, it used to be you wanted to kill 30 minutes, you turned on the TV. Most people today, they want to kill 30 minutes, they go online. And that fragmentation affects the value that the consumer is willing to attribute to that bundle that they sell.
What do you think most infuriates the networks about what it is that you do?
I don't know the answer to that. I think a lot of them are friends. I think that'd be a question better served to the networks.
Well, they'll give me a legal argument, but I mean, in a sense, you're not taking any of their money per se. There probably is some group of people who wouldn't sign up for cable because they can get your Aereo service, but it can't be that big of a number.
Well, you know, these things start, and the consumer traction that we're seeing is pretty phenomenal. But the default reaction of this industry always is first litigate, and if you lose, then try to legislate. And if you can't, then get into business with the company. So this happened with cable TV, and now they're great partners. This happened with the VCR, which gave rise to the home rental market, which they made billions and billions of dollars out of. And by the way, in all of these instances, they sued. The cases went all the way to the Supreme Court. The courts took a progressive view. And then they finally got into business with these companies and were very successful doing it.
So you're waiting for a phone call, Chet.
I firmly believe in partnership. I think the networks have a tremendous opportunity of working with Aereo in the, whenever they choose to, because we are expanding the audience. We're bringing younger people into the mix. We're bringing mobility into the mix. We're bringing social features into the mix. And all of these represent great monetization opportunities. Just to give you an example, Google is making billions of dollars on YouTube with cat videos, effectively speaking. And I find it very difficult to believe that the networks with premium content couldn't figure out a way, digital technologies, targeted advertising, and a variety of different things to make tremendous amount of revenue on advertising. And let's not forget that 90% of their revenue is advertising revenue today.
Right, and that's why they've invested in Hulu, which is their content on their platform with the subscription login fees that they control, not something that you've created taking their content.
You just said the words control, and I want to be very clear. We don't take the content. The consumer tunes the antenna and does whatever they think is appropriate, whether watch it then or record it for later, do whatever they'd like to be able to do with it. It is absolutely no different than the 57 million Americans that NAB claims uses antenna-based technologies.
So your argument is that Aereo is no different from a little old lady sitting in her room with her TV and her antenna trying to tune in the Super Bowl.
Absolutely. It is exactly the same technology, and don't take my word for it. The federal court in the Southern District of New York found that the technology functioned exactly as this was described, which was validated by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and then further, again, validated by a trial court in Boston.
How many logins does Aereo have right now?
We do not disclose our subscriber count.
Why not?
Because we're a private company and we are not required to.
Right, but I mean, Comcast, I mean, that's the first thing you hear about from them, how many subs they have. Why would you keep that number a secret?
It's not relevant in this equation. We are fortunate that we have a very passionate and extremely fastly growing base that loves our product, loves the idea. If and one day the day comes when we go public, we'll be happy to, you know, I'm sure there'll be disclosure along those lines as well. And we have invested about $100 million into the company. So our investors see the growth we are showing, and they're very happy to continue to support the business.
I love what you're doing. I use Aereo in my own home, which I ought to disclose. But in the interest of being a responsible journalist, it is curious that every other media company brags about their audience numbers, and the last thing you're going to do is tell me how many subscribers you have.
For a very simple reason. We're a private company. I would encourage you to go back to when Netflix was private and see if they disclosed subscriber numbers.
No, that's a good point. That's a good point. I mean, somebody knows, right?
I do.
It's got a few zeros after, right?
Many, yes.
Yeah. Chet Kanojia, founder and CEO of Aereo, whose case against the networks and network content being used on Aereo platforms going to the Supreme Court. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So let's finish out this hour by asking the question, who's got bragging rights?
Hi, this is James Brunson. I'm actually a soldier on Fort Knox. I remember I finished first in a race with my entire unit. There was a big space between me and the person who was behind me. And I remember turning around and I took a quote from the movie Troy and said, "Is there no one else?" But I kind of, you know, yelled it in triumph. And, you know, it got some laughs from some people. Some people clearly didn't like it, but I didn't care.
Now, James is both a guy and a confident, apparently, soldier in the U.S. Army. And according to social scientists, men may not have the right to brag, but it's easier for them to do it than for women. Here's Jesse Smith, an associate professor of psychology at Montana State University.
Research had already shown pretty robustly that men are not reluctant to talk about themselves and, in fact, will sometimes exaggerate and inflate things like their grade point average or how big that fish was that they caught.
Get out.
And whereas women will be publicly much more modest and humble. So that had been demonstrated before, and we wanted to figure out, can we fix it? Is there something we can do to help?
A way of fixing a problem so deeply ingrained in our gender identities? Well, Jessie Smith designed an experiment. She put two groups of women in a room and told them they were applying for a scholarship, a real $5,000 scholarship at MSU. One group thought they were writing the application for themselves. The other group thought they were writing for a friend. But then Professor Smith added a little twist to the experiment in the form of a strange, futuristic-looking... Well, let's just let Professor Smith explain it.
Everybody walks into the lab, and we'd made this fantastic, very scary-looking black box. It's 3 feet tall. It's black felt. It has speakers and wires coming out of it. And it's always there in the middle of the room. We tell half of them that this box is a subliminal noise generator and that it creates these noises. They're not going to be able to hear them, but that we're studying the effects of distraction on performance. And so we're going to play some distracting subliminal noises that we know will probably make them feel a little bit uncomfortable, cause some anxiety, just generally unpleasant sounds, but and that we would ask them questions about that at the end of the experiment to see how they felt and experienced that scary black box.
All right, so half of the people applying for the scholarship were told nothing except apply for the scholarship. The other half, randomly selected, were given this electronic, weird black box kind of distracting headwind, right?
That's right.
Now, what did you hope that would reveal for you as a social scientist?
So this is called the misattribution paradigm. And what we hypothesized would happen is that this black box, this subliminal noise generator, which, by the way, let me be clear, is just a box. It does nothing.
Right.
It's fake.
I suspected that. I wasn't going to call you out, but I suspected that.
And so the idea is that if you can give people an external justification, an explanation for any anxiety or discomfort that they're feeling, that they'll blame that their experience that they're having that's negative. They'll say, oh, well, that comes from this black box. That must be why I feel uncomfortable. And instead of thinking, oh, I don't really like what I'm doing.
You actually are hypothesizing that this fake black box in the middle of the room is going to give permission to modest, normed, trained women to brag about themselves, because if they feel anxiety, they're going to blame it on the black box, not on the fact that they're doing nasty bragging that they shouldn't be doing.
That's right. That's right. The thing that's so incredibly powerful about this modesty norm is even when women themselves will say, absolutely no, I do not subscribe to this. This is ridiculous. It still feels uncomfortable to do it. And so if we can give women this external reason, this thing to blame for any discomfort that they're feeling, then it frees them up to not just do a good job in self-promoting and bragging about themselves, but to actually enjoy the experience.
All right. Now, that's the theory. What did you discover?
So we had these judges look at the essays that these women wrote, and the judges had no idea that there was a box in the room or who was told what. We just said, hey, read these scholarship essays. Here's the details on the scholarship and how much money should we give them. And the women who wrote an essay about themselves to apply for the scholarship, who were told nothing about this black box, they were awarded about $1,600 on average out of $5,000. The women who wrote the essay on behalf of themselves with the black box in the room to blame any discomfort were awarded $2,600 in scholarship money, so $1,000 more.
And what about the group that wrote on behalf of someone else?
They were awarded between $2,400 and $2,600 across both groups. So the black box in the room didn't hurt or help the people writing about somebody else at all. It did nothing.
But it does reveal that, in a sense, it negates the modesty inhibitor to the point that a woman who's in the room with the, you know, distractor basically writes as honestly and forthrightly and positively about themselves as they would write about a friend.
That's right. And that is incredibly important here because the story is not that women can't write about themselves or brag about themselves or put their best foot forward. They absolutely can. And they can do it just as well as they can with writing about a friend.
Now, is it possible that you were driving once in your car and, you know, the radio reception isn't the best out there in Montana? Suddenly it got all sort of, you know, distracting on your radio, and that you realized, boom, your anxiety went away, and that's what gave you the idea for the black box?
So the idea for the black box comes from very classic social psychology literature called the misattribution paradigm, and it goes back to sleep anxiety, where they found that if you gave people who cannot fall asleep a pill that's really a sugar pill, but you don't tell them that, they take a pill that they think causes their heart to race and their breathing to increase. The insomniacs would take this pill, and then when they started feeling anxious and their heart starts racing and their breathing increases, they blamed the pill and fell asleep.
That's amazing.
And so, yeah, and so the idea is, how do you label your experience or your emotion?
I'm father to three girls, and all three of them brag. And the idea that this is not innate, I suspect, is something you'd go along with. What do you think happens to the girl who brags or who is motivated to put their best foot forward by the time they get to college?
There's really good research called the backlash effect that finds that women who do self-promote and brag and put their best foot forward, if you say the same accomplishment, but you change the gender of the person saying it, and they've done this in many studies, she's not liked. Both men and women don't like her. They don't want to be friends with her. They think she's smart, but they do not want to be her friend, and they do not want to allocate resources and rewards to her. So in some ways, women are smart enough to have figured out over time that when they violate the modesty norm, it doesn't feel good, and people aren't going to respond favorably to them.
What tangible consequence do you think from your research would help women suppress this suppressor in an actual job interview situation?
It's up to educators and employers to set the situation up in a way that really normalizes and makes self-promoting safe. And in doing that, by instead of saying, tell us, you know, about the great work that you've done, to say, please tell us the five big projects that you completed this year. So making it very specific and clear and what you're looking for. Impetus must come from the employer and the educator to go and look for the outstanding things that the women in their business is doing.
Jesse Smith, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jesse Smith is an associate professor of psychology at Montana State University. Tell us your best projects over the last year, male or female. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.